Η απόψινή ομιλία, παιδιά, είναι στη σειρά των ομιλιών που κάνουμε κάθε μήνα για σας και βέβαια φέτος είμαι σε λίγο καλύτερη θέση από τα περασμένα χρόνια, γιατί ήδη έχουμε ανακοινώσει 2-3 ομιλίες από τώρα για τους μήνες που μας έρχονται. Και νομίζω ότι όλοι οι μήνες είναι τακτοποιημένοι με τους ομιλητάς και με τα θέματα, και καθώς παίρνετε τα πρακτικά της νεολαίας, θα βλέπετε εκεί ποιοι θα είναι οι ομιλητές των επόμενων μηνών και ποιο θα είναι το θέμα. Απόψε βέβαια το θέμα είναι ένα πάρα πολύ ενδιαφέρον και είναι ιστορικό θέμα και βέβαια είναι πάρα πολύ κοντά στη γιορτή που γιορτάσαμε και τιμήσαμε τον Άγιο Κωνσταντίνο και τη μητέρα του, την Αγία Ελένη. Η μνήμη του είναι 21 Μαΐου, ήδη κάναμε τον Εσπερινό και τη Θεία Λειτουργία την περασμένη εβδομάδα, που έχουμε βέβαια και επωνόματι των Αγίων, τον Ιερό Ναό των Αγίων Κωνσταντίνου και Ελένης, στο South Yara. Οι Άγιοι αυτοί οι δυο είναι πάρα πολύ συμπαθείς Άγιοι στην ελληνική Ορθοδοξία, στους Έλληνας Ορθοδόξους, γιατί όπως γνωρίζετε ήταν ο Αυτοκράτορας ο πρώτος. Από αυτόν ουσιαστικά αρχίζει το Βυζάντιο και βέβαια ήταν εκείνος ο Αυτοκράτορας ο οποίος βοήθησε πάρα πολύ τους χριστιανούς. Και οι χριστιανοί τον απεδέχθησαν και τον αγιοποίησαν και μόνον γι' αυτό το πράγμα, ότι τους απείλαξε από τους διωγμούς και τα βάσανα, που έκανε πολλά άλλα πράγματα, γιατί πολλοί αμφιβάλλουν αν είναι Άγιος, αν έπρεπε να τον κάνει η Εκκλησία Άγιο, διότι πολλές φορές, διότι αναφέρουν και περιπτώσεις κατά τις οποίες είχε δώσει εντολή να σκοτώσουν ανθρώπους κτλ. Εκείνο βέβαια που πρέπει να ενθυμούμεθα πάντοτε, να έχουμε στο μυαλό μας, we have to keep in mind, that saint, it is not εκείνος που είναι αναμάρτητος, χωρίς αμαρτίες. It is not a person without sins. Αλλά είναι ένα πρόσωπο το οποίο αγωνίζεται για να απαλλαχτεί από τις αμαρτίες. Κανένας από μας δεν είναι αναμάρτητος. Όλοι έχουμε αμαρτίες. Αλλά όλοι οι Άγιοι από τους ανθρώπους έγιναν. Γιατί αγωνίστηκαν εναντίον της αμαρτίας και την επάλεψαν και έτσι έγιναν Άγιοι. Αναμάρτητος είναι μόνον ο Θεός. Εκείνος δεν κάνει αμαρτίες. Όλοι εμείς κάνουμε αμαρτίες, αλλά έχουμε τη μετάνοια και μετανιώνουμε και εφόσον μετανιώνουμε συγχωρούμεθα. Και όταν συγχωρούμεθα, το έλεος του Θεού μπορεί να μας χαρίσει πολλά πράγματα. Δεν θα πω περισσότερα πράγματα εγώ, θα αφήσω τον αγαπητό Διονύσιο να τα πει, ο οποίος είναι ο απόψινός ομιλητής. Ο Διονύσιος είναι απόφυτος, όπως όλοι γνωρίζετε, της θεολογικής μας σχολής στο Σίδνεϊ. Βρίσκεται τώρα εδώ. Έχει αυτή τη στιγμή διδάσκει θρησκευτικά και βέβαια προχωρεί και με τις σπουδές του. Αγωνίζεται συνεχώς να πάρει κάτι μεγαλύτερο δίπλωμα και πτυχίο για να μπορέσει έτσι να γίνει περισσότερο χρήσιμος στην Εκκλησία και στην Ομογένεια και γενικότερα στην κοινωνία όπου ζούμε, την Αυστραλιανή κοινωνία. Ο Διονύσιος είναι γιος του πατρός Κρινά, πατρός Αντωνίου. Έχει σύζυγο και τέκνο, μάλιστα. Και έτσι είναι ένα από τα καλά μας παιδιά βεβαίως. Δεν θέλω να σας το συστήνω έτσι για να καμαρώνει εκείνος πως είναι καλός, αλλά είναι πραγματικά καλός και κάνει πολύ καλή δουλειά όπου τον έχουμε, όπου του έχουμε αναθέσει. Κάνει δουλειά πάρα πολύ καλά. Και δεν αμφιβάλλω πως απόψε στην ομιλία του θα είναι πάρα πολύ καλός. Γι' αυτό παρακαλώ να τον προσέξετε. Και όταν έχετε ερωτήσεις, θα πρέπει να τον ρωτήσετε όταν τελειώσει την ομιλία, χωρίς κανένα δισταγμό. Γιατί οπωσδήποτε πολλοί θα γνωρίζετε λίγα πράγματα για τον Άγιο που θα μας μιλήσει απόψε. Σας ευχαριστώ πάρα πολύ που ανταποκριθήκατε και απόψε στην ομιλία και ότι δεν είστε πάρα πολλοί. Αλλά βέβαια πιστεύω ότι έχουν και εξετάσεις πολλά από τα παιδιά αυτές τις ημέρες. Και έτσι, έστω και ολίγοι ακόμα, όλο το φύραμα ζυμώνουν οι λίγοι, λέγει η Γραφή, από την χούφτα των Αποστόλων έγινε όλος ο κόσμος χριστιανός. Λοιπόν, παρακαλώ τον Διονύση να έρθει να σας αρχίσει την ομιλία. Ευχαριστώ πολύ.
It's always difficult to begin a speech when you get such a good introduction. It creates very big shoes for you to have to fill. Ευχαριστώ, Θεοφιλέστατε. The topic, Saint Constantine, a saint, with a question mark next to that, I must admit, was done on purpose in order to generate interest. By creating a topic where you would question the canonization or make it look like you're questioning the canonization of an Orthodox saint, I was hoping would draw people to come tonight, and it has done that, thankfully. But tonight I am not here to say that Saint Constantine the Great was no saint. However, the purpose of this talk is to show why people believe that for some certain reasons he shouldn't be a saint. If you look amongst the saints of the Catholic Church, he's not recognized as a saint amongst the saints of the Catholic Church, those recognized by the Catholic Church, yet he is recognized as a saint in the Orthodox Church. And I wanted to show the reasons why people question that, and then present an argument that explains why he is in actual fact a saint of our church. If you take a coin from your pocket, any coin, you'll find on one side at least the head of Queen Elizabeth. Common practice from early times where the ruler of a particular nation had their image imprinted onto a coin. Well, Saint Constantine the Great was certainly one of those emperors. He's a standard copper coin with his image on one side. That quote there is from a historian, Eusebius, and it reads, "And God himself, whom Constantine worshipped, has confirmed this truth by the clearest manifestations of his will, during the course and at the end of his reign, and holding him up to the human race as an instructive example of godliness." When I first read that, I had a huge problem with it. God himself, whom Constantine worshipped, has confirmed this truth by the clearest manifestations. I thought, is that telling me that God worshipped Constantine? And I sat down and I read it again, and I thought, no. God himself, whom Constantine worshipped. So it's something I found when I read. I just wanted to make sure that mistake wasn't made by anyone. Eusebius was a historian, and he held Constantine in the most highest regards, and he's written a whole book on him, and a lot of the information which I'm using tonight is taken directly from Eusebius' writings. Okay? There's the topic of our talk. I've put that icon in because it depicts Saint Constantine without a beard, and there are icons which depict him with a beard, and this is another whole topic for discussion, how he should be depicted. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. What matters is the fact that he is a saint, and whether we depict him with a beard or not is not a concern for us. Okay, let's just have a look at briefly Constantine's life in history. Before I get started, though, it's important to mention that many saints of the church are recognized as saints for the life they lived and for the person that they were. Saint Constantine the Great was not recognized as a saint because of his personality or because of his day-to-day living. He was recognized as a saint because of what he did for Christianity. Because he made Christianity legal. Before his time, you could not practice Christianity without being persecuted. If you did, you'd have to be good at hiding it, and the early Christians would go in caves and in hiding places in order to practice their religion, their faith. In Christian history, Constantine is portrayed as a wonderful man who did everything right. The early books of Constantine seem to only speak about all the positives of his life. For some reason, obviously done on purpose, all the negatives have been left out. And why would they try to make him look bad when Constantine stopped the persecution of Christians and made Christianity not only an important religion, but the religion of the state? This obviously made him popular amongst Christians. If you're a Christian, all of a sudden you're allowed to practice something that you believed in, you'd obviously be happy. If we today were told that we wouldn't have to pay tolls coming to the city, we'd be very happy if the government lifted that. Me in particular, because I live in Dandenong, and I pass under that many of them, it gets really frustrating. So for the next 1,000 years, most of the historians that were Christian, their accounts of him were very flattering. Some details on him. Constantine was born on the 27th on February, and whether it's 272 or 273, that's not exactly sure. Some historians even date him at 274. His birth name was Flavius Valerius Constantius, a very Latin name, and he was son of Constantius and Helena, and that is a rock carving of his image depicted there. Now, growing up, we can see that there are some very early elements of Christianity in his life growing up as a boy. We know that his parents were born pagans. We know that they weren't Christian at the time of his birth. However, there are small traces that show us that he was exposed to Christianity. One of his sisters was called Anastasia, and Anastasia is a Christian name, yet she was born a pagan. So his parents liked the name, obviously, and weren't ashamed to call their daughter a Christian name, something which you would be very much likely to be shunned for and looked down upon. They might be Christians. Why have they given their child a Christian name? They obviously didn't care. They loved the name. Furthermore, his sister Constantia, she herself became a Christian when Constantine was a young boy. Okay? After she becomes a Christian, she seems to disappear from the books of history and we have no other records of her. Now, while he was staying in the court of Diocletian, he would often question the persecution of Christians. At the time, the empire, I'll go into this in much more detail, was split in two, and there was a ruler in the west and a ruler in the east. Now, let's say myself and His Grace were the two rulers. What we would do is we would hold someone ransom to ensure that the other ruler didn't do anything against us. So I have a son, and my son would stay at His Grace's court, and His Grace would leave something which he cherishes very much, and he would leave that in my court, so that if there was ever a chance that we didn't trust each other, we always had someone there whom we could hold as ransom and threaten each other with. Okay? Constantine was staying in the court of Diocletian. And it was there, growing up, that he would often question, why are we killing these people? Why are we persecuting them? Okay? He could never understand why. So, obviously, there is a sign of compassion there, and a sign, some symbols of love, and perhaps even a leaning towards Christianity from that early age. Okay, this is the Tetrarchy. Diocletian, a famous Roman emperor, was renowned for taking the Roman Empire and saying, look, it's too big for one person to run. Let's break it up into pieces. So he broke it up into half. And you'd have one ruler ruling each half, and each ruler would have the title Augustus. Now again, it was still a lot of work, so what you would do was you'd choose someone who would be your helper, okay? And like a junior ruler, and that ruler would be known as Caesar. Okay? Now, Constantine came along and thought, like, when he eventually came into power, we'll get to how he got to power just in a minute. He destroyed the whole Tetrarchy system and restored the concept of a sole ruler. All right? Now, just keep that in mind because that's important for later. So if we have a look at the empire at the time, there's a line down the center, and there's what the empire would have looked like. The orange denotes the boundaries of the Roman Empire. Now they were constantly changing. Okay, they were never permanently clear, but the changes were minor, and that's a good average estimation of what the empire looked like. Egypt, however, you can't see. They had the majority of Egypt also, what is today Egypt. Okay, so you'd have one ruler in the east and one ruler in the west. Just a bit of history here. I won't be much longer with the history. Okay. Now, Constantine's father was an Illyrian general in the west. And we don't have too much history or too much information about him as a general. What we do know is that he became Augustus in the west. Constantine's father became Augustus in the west in 293 AD. And he passed away in 306 AD. So he was there for 13 years. Okay, approximately 13 years as Augustus. Now, because Constantine was his son, you would think that automatically he's the next in line to take the throne, but that was always discussed by Rome first, which was the central headquarters of the Roman Empire, and they would decide whether or not this next person, who was the son of the ruler who had passed away, was the right person for the job. In 308, because no decision was made, Constantine decided to declare himself Augustus of the West. However, things didn't go according to plan. What we have here is a picture of the Milvian Bridge. It sits today inside. It's today in Italy, and I'll just... What I've pointed to is the actual remnants of the original bridge. Okay, that's a bridge built in the 18th century, but those bits there are remnants of the original bridge, which existed 300 years after the time of Christ. Big deal, you might say. What's this got to do with the talk? Rome, however, had declared that the Augustus should really be a man called Maxentius, and that Constantine should be his Caesar. So Constantine was to be his helper. Constantine didn't like this. He felt that he was the rightful heir to the throne and ruler Augustus of the West. And the history books I found often vary in this, but we're told he had anything between 10 and 40,000 soldiers at his disposal who really supported him. And we're told that Maxentius had anything between 40 and 100,000 soldiers. What I found as an average was that in a battle, Constantine was against the odds because he was approximately anything between 5 to 10 to 1. So he didn't have the majority of soldiers to win the battle. And all he had to do, if he wanted to take power of the West, was to kill Maxentius in battle, to defeat him. Killing him wasn't ultimately necessary, but by defeating him in a battle, he would prove that he was the better ruler and therefore take his throne. And the Battle of the Milvian Bridge is one of the most famous battles in history because Constantine ordered a full-on charge onto his enemies, and they had their backs against the river, and he managed to push them into the river, and a lot of them were drowned, and they couldn't all cross the bridge at the same time, and it was a decisive battle. And by winning the battle and by killing Maxentius, he became emperor of the West, the Augustus of the West. Now that is just a quick summary of his rise to power. There he is on another coin. Constantine's, his goals were, when he came to power, were because he saw the oppression of Christians and he wanted to put an end to this and create an empire where there was religious freedom. Okay, that was one of his goals. And another one of his goals was that he wanted to create his own power. Okay, and that's one of the reasons why he eliminated the tetrarchy system and wanted to be the sole ruler of the empire. And so we get to our question. A saint. Why do people question Saint Constantine as a saint? Now, I'm not here to scandalize anyone, but as His Grace said, there were moments and times where Constantine ordered that people be killed. And as a ruler of a country, For example, let's take John Howard, for instance, who sent soldiers to the Gulf. By sending soldiers to the Gulf, he put their lives in risk and the people who those soldiers would be fighting against at risk. So as a leader of a country, you're often faced with decisions where you put people in life-threatening situations. So let's have a look at this. Upon his rise to power, or just before, sorry, in July 306 AD, these were the people of power, people in the courts, and who were all successors and likely people to take the throne, and some of them did take the throne of Augustus and as Caesar around the time of Constantine. There was Severus, who became Augustus in the east, Constantius, Constantine's father, Maximian, Maximus Dea, Galerius, and Maxentius. And Maxentius was the one whom Constantine fought at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. Through Constantine's orders, of those six men, five of them were killed through orders of Constantine. There's Constantine, that's number seven. And there's Licinius, another ruler who was actually, who later became Augustus of the East. By June 313 AD, all six had died. Only Constantius, Constantine's father, died of an illness. The rest of them died because Constantine ordered their deaths, ordered them to be killed. Maxentius through battle, and the others because they either opposed him or were in a position which he wanted. And so by killing them, having someone kill them, he eliminated his enemies. This is one of the major reasons why people question him being a saint. So in his rise to power, this is just another look at this, the only two left in 313 AD were Constantine and Licinius. The others were dead. Constantine, ruler of the west, Licinius, ruler of the east. Let's have a look at some more things. He killed two of his sons, Crispus and Constantine. And the reason for that was because he had a suspicion and no proof, and to this day there exists no proof, he had a suspicion that they were plotting to take his throne. So the next one, he brought about the death of Fausta, mother of three of his other sons, and he had more than one wife. All things that people say, what's then a saint to us? He's talking about a saint of the church. Is it possible that this saint of our church committed these sins? But who is sinless? Jesus Christ. Everyone else in this room, on this earth, commits sins. Saint Constantine, other saints of the church, but it is through the grace of God that our sins can be forgiven. Reconciliation through confession or baptism. And please remember the or baptism. We'll get to that near the end of this talk. Okay? But you can understand why people do question his position as a saint. Now, in 325, this is taking a jump in history, about 12 years ahead. He had a battle with Licinius because he was making his final attempt to be sole ruler of the whole empire. Remember, he was only up until this time ruler of the West. And after defeating him in 325 AD, he sent him away along with his son. His son was a very good general. He sent him away and let him go. Okay. However, soon after, he changed his mind and said, well, what if Licinius goes and regains the faith of his soldiers, builds an army, and then I have to fight him again? I'll just kill him. And that's what he did. One other thing which Constantine did was he made the citizens pay a heavy tax called Chrysargyron. And it says that the tax was so bad that even the Christians complained. When he was in power and made Christianity legal, the Christians loved him very much. But the one thing that they had to complain about was the heavy taxes. And the taxes went to none other than himself. He wore lavish clothes, as emperors do. He wore a lavish crown, as emperors do. He had a huge palace, as emperors had large palaces. However, there were a lot of other good things which he did with his money, with the money. We'll have a look at them later. Okay. One of the reasons why Christianity was able to spread, this goes back similar to a talk I had done previously, was because there was a large mix-up between solar monotheism and Christianity. Does anyone know what solar monotheism is? Apollo, in ancient Greek mythology, was known as the sun god. Okay? And the sun was seen as a god which people worship. And so a big confusion existed. When Christians were often preaching, people became mixed up and said, the sun in the sky, S-U-N, the son of God, S-O-N, is it the same thing? And the uneducated people were confused and didn't think they were changing faiths. They just believed that this sun in the sky had come down to earth in the form of a man and had preached Christianity. And so there was a mix-up and a confusion, but it actually assisted Christianity to grow quite quickly. And so in his rise to power, he had a lot of support from pagans and Christians. Christianity and the solar religion became entangled. And let's have a look at some more of these reasons. Pagans imagined that the Christians worshipped the sun because they met on Sundays and prayed towards the east. Now, all Orthodox churches that have been built correctly are supposed to face the east, okay, the rising of the sun. And because Christians pray facing the sun, as we do on Sundays, if our church is facing the east, okay, pagans thought that we were praying to the sun. So Sunday morning, the day of the sun, was known as the day of the sun, S-U-N, that's why it's spelled S-U-N-D-A-Y. When they would see Christians praying, they thought, oh, they worship the sun. And when the royal doors are opened, you'll notice that in a church that faces the east, the early Sunday morning beams, particularly in summer, shine through, and it's very nice. If you've ever been at church early enough to see it. Okay, Clement of Alexandria, he speaks of Christ driving the chariot across the sky like a sun god. A lot of his documentation was documentation which Christians would pick up and read. And here's the big one. The celebration on the 25th of December, the birthday of the sun god, at the winter solstice, as the date for the nativity of Christ. Many people argue that the birth of Christ was placed on the 25th of December on purpose, because the 25th of December, before the coming of Christ, was the day when we celebrated the summer solstice, the longest day of the year. Tradition of the time stated that the emperor who placed himself under Apollo's protection was called to determine the destiny of the whole empire, and Constantine was seen as praying to the god Apollo. A lot of people didn't know who he was really praying to, whether he was praying to the son of God or the sun in the sky. Here we have here the Ark of Constantine. After the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, he had this built. Still stands today. There are a few problems with it, though. In the tradition of the period, the Ark of Constantine is a usurped monument, and it depicts the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, where Constantine defeated Maxentius. And inscribed in the arch, Constantine, it says, Constantine overcame his enemies by divine inspiration. We'll talk about that soon. This is the major problem. On it, Constantine has depicted God driving a chariot, which is the sun, across the sky. And so, all this information which I've just spoken about concludes at this point here, that Constantine himself believed that the God which he was, the God of Christianity, was the sun in the sky. He himself was confused. Here's a coin of Constantine. And its inscription honors the pagan sun god Apollo, yet he continued to produce them even after his conversion. Okay? Constantine himself, Eusebius tells us, was not totally aware of the mutual exclusiveness between Christianity and his faith in the unconquered sun. People say, how could he be a saint of the church if he could not tell the difference between the sun in the sky and the Son of God? If he doesn't know who the center of our Christian faith is, and he has it mixed up with the sun in the sky, how could he possibly be a saint? So this is the second main reason why people question Constantine being a saint of the church. I'm just throwing this one in as an extra. Constantine on a coin. This is one of the most common copper coins of Constantine between the years 312 and 320. And the figure is of Sol. Sol was another sun god. And you can tell because of the headdress. You can see the spikes on his head. The writing around the coin reads, Soli Invicto Comiti, which translates as Sol Invincible Comrade. Okay? I always had a problem with that when I read it up. I thought, is this the right Constantine? Are we talking about the right saint of the church? The church has called him Megas, great, yet he can't tell the difference. Succession. Okay. Constantine's sons, now these are two of his other sons, he didn't kill these two. The second, Constantine II, Constantius and Constance, and the son of his half-brother, Flavius Dalmatius Jr., would be the heirs of his throne. I've put this one in because it says that Constantine's plan was for them to rule the empire as a tetrarchy again. And it was seen as a thoughtless move because he had just destroyed the old tetrarchy. Constantine was very proud of himself, and he firmly believed that he was the only person ever capable enough of ruling the empire properly as a sole ruler. And when he placed heirs to his throne, he placed four sons, the original setup of the empire. Put this one in because it shows us that he lacked humility. Eusebius himself says that Constantine very rarely showed humility. Often in arguments, he wouldn't back down. He didn't like being proven wrong in front of others. And just this simple act, by placing his four sons to rule the empire instead of him as sole ruler, clearly indicate that he lacked humility. If you look at a lot of the saints of our church, some of the Desert Fathers, their life was imbued in humility. So, again, people question why he was a saint. So, was he a saint? Yes or no? Let's find out why Constantine the Great is not only a saint, but one of the greatest people in the history of the church. Yes. Here's a common depiction of St. Constantine the Great. Alright. Now let's have a look at the other side of Constantine, the Christian Constantine. Before the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, Constantine saw a cross in the sky with the inscription, "Conquer by this." He fought for the cross and was victorious in the battle. He made Christianity the religion of the empire and stopped the persecution of Christians. And here we have an artist's depiction of what it looked like, and in Latin, in hoc signo vinces, Constantine's sign from God. And this is a quote from Eusebius, a historian, and he says, "At about noon, when the day was already beginning to decline, he saw with his own eyes the trophy of a cross of light in the heavens above the sun, and the inscription, in hoc signo vinces, by this conquer, en tuto nica. At this sight, he himself was struck with amazement. And look at this part very carefully. And his whole army also, which followed him on an expedition and witnessed the miracle. What Constantine saw was a miracle from God. God said to him, take this symbol, put it on your flags. He didn't actually say this, but this is the message that he got. Put it on your flags, and I will give you the strength to win the battle of the Milvian Bridge. Remember, Constantine was largely outnumbered. His men would never have followed him into battle when they were so highly outnumbered. Maxentius had one of the best experienced armies in the whole empire. Constantine's soldiers knew this. Yet a historical documentation by Eusebius tells us that his whole army saw the cross in the sky and explicit orders from God himself telling him to use that as their symbol to win the battle. But that's not all. Here's an artist's depiction with a cross in the sky. The picture was about the size of my thumbnail, and I found it on the internet. And I expanded and then I enlarged it. But believe it or not, inside the cross is the writing, In hoc signo vinces in tuto nica. Excuse me. Okay, so you have Constantine up on a high pedestal and soldiers around him witnessing the magical event. Not magical, the miracle. Okay. Eusebius tells us something else. In his sleep, the Christ of God appeared to him, this is Constantine, with a sign which he had seen in the heavens, and commanded him to make a likeness of that sign which he had seen in the heavens, and to use it as a safeguard of all engagements with his enemies. So, in addition to seeing that in the sky, Constantine saw in his dream the Lord telling him to take that symbol, which is known as the hero, he for the Greek letter he, and ro, and there's also the iota there, which stands for Jesus Christos, Jesus Christ. And all Constantine's soldiers had that placed on their shields. So in fact, they looked like this huge amass of soldiers bearing the sign of the name of Christ on their shields, walking under the banner of the cross. A Christian army. An army which knew it had already won the battle because it had seen a miracle in the sky telling them that using that sign, using the symbol of the cross and the hero, that they would win the battle. So Constantine was chosen by God to take the reins of the empire, to rule the empire, because he would make it legal. He would make everything right. And I honestly do believe that it is not just coincidence that Constantine was born at that particular time. This happens to be probably the center and highlight of Constantine's life. The Edict of Milan was an edict which Constantine himself brought forth and was issued in 313 AD. What was it all about? The Edict of Milan made Christianity legal. Previously it had been illegal. By making it legal, okay, you didn't have to worry about being persecuted anymore. You didn't have to worry about hiding to do your cross, hiding in a cave to take Holy Communion from a priest. Now Christianity was legal. And not only did Constantine make Christianity legal, but he made it the official religion of the empire. The official religion of the empire. And I'll say it again, this is the center point of his time as emperor. And this is probably his most famous and great act for the church, and one of the main reasons why he became a saint. He took Christianity from darkness and brought it into light. He took something that was illegal and persecuted, and not only made it legal, but made it official. This is our religion. This is what you, as people in this empire, are expected, not forced, expected to follow, this religion. Furthermore, Constantine was instrumental in instigating the Council of Nicaea, the first ecumenical council. There are seven ecumenical councils in the church, and the purpose was whenever a particular decision needed to be made regarding the church, regarding dogma or church teachings, and there was a disagreement in the church, and there was a possibility that a huge schism could occur, ecumenical councils were called. Ecumenical councils involved all the bishops coming together and voting. Each bishop has one vote, and we believe that all decisions made by ecumenical councils, we have seven of them, are decisions made with the guidance of the Holy Spirit. So it's not each and every bishop coming up with his or their own opinion. They are guided to a particular decision by the grace of the Holy Spirit. Now, the first Council of Nicaea was the very first one called. And it was Constantine who set about calling it, chairing the council at one stage, and very much bringing everyone together in order to come to the right decision. What was the first ecumenical council all about? Arianism. Sorry, the council was called on the 20th of May in 325 AD. Very important date. Okay. And the council condemned Arianism. Arius was a very intelligent and well-knowledge scholar, but he believed that Christ was not the same as God. He believed that God held a position which was above that of Christ. He saw Christ as a human, as the Son of God, but as a human, and not as God. And the Council of Nicaea came up with the very famous term homoousios, of the same essence. That Jesus Christ and God were of the same essence. Okay? Very important. They also came up, also wrote the creed. Every Sunday you'll hear it at church. The first version of the creed came out with the first ecumenical council. However, there's more. The first ecumenical council was not only about Arianism. It dealt with visible organization of the church, which went on for quite a while. And it ruled the day of commemoration of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It said that it decided and declared how we would practice and how we would commemorate Jesus' resurrection every year. Furthermore, Constantine built and restored many Christian churches. The bigger churches were beautiful, with mosaics covering the floors. A lot of the money, which I mentioned before, which he was raising from the Chrysavirion, is going to this, directly to this, building and making the churches beautiful. And Constantine often set aside time for himself to go and pray. And he frequently preached in various churches during his reign. He forbid work on Sunday. Constantine was the very first ruler to come out and say, the first day of the week, Sunday, will be the day of rest. Kyriaki. Here we have one of the most famous churches which Constantine built. That's all that's left of it today. But it's a huge church and still exists. That's the remnants of it that still exist. Constantine did something else which was very important. He moved the capital of the empire from Rome to Constantinople. Okay, Rome was known as the center of the empire, and he took it and moved it over to the east. The city was dedicated on May 11, 330 AD as a private imperial residence, but it was not until 359 that it became the new capital of the empire. So he was living and ruling from Constantinople, but it wasn't for another 29 years that it was declared the capital, officially. Constantinople was a Christian capital. Okay, I got it spelled right there. That's much better. It was built on the site of a Greek city, Byzantium, and it was an excellent location of trade. Constantinople, today Istanbul, sits on the meeting point of Europe and the Middle East, and is one of the greatest strategically placed cities of the world. And it was, in actual fact, Constantine saw that it was a better position to rule the empire because it was more central than Rome, more central for the whole empire. Burial. This is quite funny. Eusebius compares Constantine and his bishops to the apostles and Jesus Christ, because what he actually did was, when he was buried, he also had 12 empty sarcophaguses buried with him to symbolize that he himself was the 13th apostle, because he really believed that. He's dead. Does anyone know when Constantine actually was baptized and became a Christian? I'm sure a lot of you do. You're probably too shy to speak. On his deathbed. Very good. Constantine fell ill and was baptized by the bishop Eusebius. It was common practice in those days not to get baptized right up until the last few moments of your life. That way, all your sins would be forgiven. Baptism, the entering, when you see the little baby enter the holy water, and not just any holy water, but mega agiasmo, and is baptized, the baby is then receives new life. The baby receives new life because it is baptized and all sins are forgiven. Of course, you'll say, what sins does a baby have? But this goes for anyone. Anyone who is baptized is fully cleansed of all sin. And so the thought in those days was, well, I'll wait till just before I die. That way I won't commit any sins. So that way, as many sins as I commit, I will have them washed away just before I die. And that's what Constantine did. So yes, he may have lived a sinful life, but he died virtually sin-free. He died in Ancyrana on May 22, 337, and his body was buried in Constantinople. Now, the date of his death, May 22nd, is often argued. I found three sources that said the 22nd and two that said the 21st. I wasn't sure which one to put down, but I put down May 22nd. However, he is commemorated on the 21st of May by the church. Saint Constantine the Great. A saint? Yes. Having looked at all of the above, we'd have to conclude that, yes, he did live a sinful life. He did order that people be killed. However, he's not considered a saint for the life that he lived, but for the decisions which he placed upon the church and therefore changed the life of the church forever. Where's Spiro? Can you give those out, please, Spiro? Sam, can you give him a hand, please? Because there's quite a few people. Thanks, mate. What I'm passing around is just a little quote from Eusebius. What he did for the church was something ultimately amazing. And in conclusion, we'd have to say that he's changed the church forever. He changed the church forever. What he did was something totally amazing and something which we today, up till this day, live. The freedom to practice our faith, to practice our religion as we choose. Does everyone have one? We're going to read through this together. How are we doing for time? This is a quote by Eusebius And it is a quote which Eusebius speaks about occurring the day Christianity was declared legal and the official religion of the church. This will give you a taste of how things changed. This will let you know how different things were. Men had now lost all fear of their former oppressors. So if you're a Christian and you would walk around the streets, you would be scared that a particular soldier or a Roman official would see you and kill you or persecute you for being Christian. Now, those same people who you would bump into, you were no longer afraid of. Think about people that you might see today walking along in the street that you may try to avoid or not want to speak to because for whatever reason. Well, all of a sudden, all those feelings of fear and angst were gone. Day after day, they kept dazzling festival. They celebrated day after day. Light was everywhere. And men, this is for me the favorite part of this whole quote. Men, it says men, ladies, speaking, but it's actually speaking about males and females. It's an ancient, it's an old written piece. And if you were a writer or a historian, you only included females in your writing if it was absolutely necessary. So when it says men, it's actually talking about human beings in general. Men who once dared not look up greeted each other with smiling faces and shining eyes. Smiling faces and shining eyes. So instead of seeing someone who you would in secret go to church with on a Sunday and you wouldn't look up at them just in case someone realized that you were both Christians greeting each other, now all of a sudden you could walk up to them, pat them on the back. And as we do now, say Christos Anesti, Alithos Anesti, something which they couldn't do beforehand. They danced and sang in city and country alike, giving honor first of all to God, our sovereign Lord, as they had been instructed. Constantine declared that, yes, celebrate that Christianity has become legal. However, give thanks to God first. Old troubles were forgotten, and all irreligion passed into oblivion. Good things were enjoyed, and those yet to come eagerly awaited. Thank you.
Thanks. By the way, it was very informative and good talk. Thank you. You mentioned earlier in the talk that St. Constantine was not completely aware of God being the Son or God being God. Would he have been educated through the first councils on proper Christianity? So before his death, he would have had that awareness of what Christianity was?
That's a terrific question, absolutely. He would have had around him some of the greatest scholars of his time. Being at the first ecumenical council, he would have been able to meet some of the fathers of the church. And there is no way, I don't think, that he would have gone to that council being uneducated to that fact. He most certainly would have known, and probably better than a lot of other scholars at the time. No, but the thing is, when he built the arch and when he won the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, he did not know much at all about Christianity. Good question.
One more question. I've heard, this is not something I've read, but I've heard from various places that during his last days, St. Constantine became like a recluse and was very contemplative towards Christianity before he became baptized. Is that right?
Very much. Very much. And there is a letter which says, which is written from, I think, one of the men in his court to someone in the West, saying that he cries and laments over all the bad things that he did and that he was truly sorry. But then again, although it's a written historical piece, that could be something which was made up at the time. We don't know. However, I honestly do believe that he regretted everything that he had done. I believe that the saints of the church which we have today, it's not just by chance that we get them. the church guides us into understanding who the saints of our church are. I don't think the world is not a wind-up toy which God creates and lets run free. We have the church here today in order to guide us and steer us through times. We had the ecumenical councils which declared to us our faith, and I don't think the church would allow us to be guided to believe in or pray and ask for a saint's help who wasn't really a saint.
Can we argue that Constantine was baptized and became a Christian at the end of his life, and this was part of God's God being all-knowing, because God knew that Constantine was going to do all these terrible things during his life and was going to do all these good things. And as we know, once you're baptized, the negative things that you've done in your life cease to be a part of that life. And therefore, the church, in determining whether he was going to be elevated to a saint, took that into account, plus all the good things that he did. And can we argue this? And also, with the Catholic Church and the first ecumenical council arguing that, or with the church arguing that, what was it? Not Nestorianism. What did you call it? I can't
Arianism.
Remember. Arianism. Can we argue that the Catholic Church today has a tendency towards Arianism, since one of the differences, as far as I understand, between our church and the Catholic Church is that Christ is Christ and not God in the Catholic Church, whereas we believe that Christ is God as well. That's what came out of...
That is... No. They don't believe that. And I thought... Okay. They believe what we believe, and they accept... they are accepting the Seventh Ecumenical Councils,
okay,
as we do. We have a lot of similarities with the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
A lot of similarities. Tradition, Holy Bible, and so on.
Okay.
History, and the troubles started later on, okay, in the church. So up to 8th century, we were all together.
Mm.
And we are accepting whatever the ecumenical councils decided and so on. And even today, we have common beliefs in all decisions of the ecumenical council. No. Something that I would like very much to add what Dionysius told you tonight. It was a very nice speech, and I believe that you understand it very well. I would like also to mention his mother, Helena. She was the one that helped the son to grow in Christianity. He knew a lot about Christianity, and the mother was the one who taught him about Christianity. And he was loving his mother very much. For this reason, when he became Autocrator, he declared his mother as Augusta, as San Autocratera. He didn't declare one of his wives as Autocratera, but his mother. And she stayed as Augusta, and she died as Augusta and buried as such. And not only that, but also Constantine the Great helped his mother to bring her dreams in reality. Her dream was to visit the Holy Land and to try to found the Holy Cross. And he gave his mother what it was necessary for that journey, money, soldiers, and so on. And she went to the Holy Land, and she found all the places where Lord was walking, or born, or risen, and she builded lovely churches there. Some of the churches of what we see today and we visit are from the time of Helen the Good, the mother of Constantine the Great. So don't forget that. Of course, he has been baptized in his last days, but he grew into Christianity and he knew a lot about Christ and about this new faith. For this reason, he's seen that through the Christians, he's going to become a great, his nation is going to become a great nation, and of course, his people will be in the future, all of them Christians, as it happened.
In answer to the first part of your question, sorry, George, just one minute. Timothy Weir actually argues that because Constantine was baptized just before his death, that was part of God's mission, part of God's greater plan. Yes, that's an argument by Timothy Weir.
I was going to ask about the confusion that existed between the Son God and Jesus being the Son of God. It seems to me that the confusion would have arisen if the word Son in Latin was the same for both Son and both sons.
Yes.
Otherwise, I couldn't understand how the confusion could have arisen.
Because I mentioned before that the 25th of December, the summer solstice, some people argue that Jesus was placed on that same day, the celebration of his birth. Of course, we don't know exactly when he was born, the date, but the church placed his birth and commemoration of his birth on that date, and many say on purpose, in order to have people who were not well enough educated, but not willing to listen and learn about Christ, to in actual fact be confused. It's an argument which people say. I don't know whether it's true or not, but it was an argument.
We should not forget that in the beginning, at least for after 300 after Christ, this particular feast day of birth of Christ was celebrated in the East, 25th of December. Before that, all Christians in the East, we celebrated Christmas together with the Epiphany Day, 6th of January. And first, the West separated the day of Christmas from the day of the Epiphany. Later on, also we brought it from the West into East, in Constantinople. And the great fathers and great fathers of the church, St. Basil, St. Chrysostom, they are the ones that they brought this celebration in the East, 25th of December. And that it came, of course, later from the time of Constantine the Great. And some of Christians, they do celebrate today, on the Epiphany Day, also Christmas Day. They don't have a separate day of Christmas and separate day of Epiphany. They celebrate it together. All the Monophysites churches, they do celebrate together. Επομένως, όλο αυτό που κουβεντιάζουμε είναι μία σκέψη. It is just a thought concerning the name Son and so on. Γιατί εμείς δεν το γιορτάζαμε. Στην Δύση, στην Ανατολή, γιορτάζαμε επιφάνεια του Θεού. Μόνο και μαζί με την επιφάνεια του Θεού, διότι όντως, really, the birth of Christ was the epiphany of Christ on earth, the God on earth. Και τα δύο γεγονότα, and both events, they are shown to us the epiphany of God on earth. Μάλιστα. Any other question? Και ύστερα, παιδιά, μην ξεχνάτε ένα άλλο πράγμα. We shall remember many times. A lot of people by that time, they confused when they seen our Lord talking or speaking, or seen the apostles preaching Christianity amongst Greeks. They believe in 12 gods and so on. Και even in Asia Minor, when St. Paul and his disciple went to preach, they start worshiping them as gods. Θυμάστε τι είπε ο Παύλος σε μία από τις πόλεις. Ναι, έσχισε τα ρούχα του. Όταν ήρθαν στην Μακεδονία, στους Φιλίππους. Τι κάνετε, εμείς δεν είμαστε θεοί. We are not gods. We came to preach you about God. And who is God? Καταλάβατε. Ήταν, τότε έβλεπαν, σου λέει, και ο Θεός ήρθε. Και άμα έβλεπαν τους Αποστόλους, έκαναν και κανένα θαύμα. Because the Apostles, they did some miracles. When they see some miracles, they say, God, they are gods. Γιατί ήταν μεγαλωμένοι μέσα στην ειδωλολατρία. Πίστευαν είδωλα. Ναι. Yes.
In Old Testament prophecy, Christ is also mentioned, called the Son of Righteousness, and that's S-U-N, or Ilios Tis Dikaiosynes. And Clement of Alexandria, father of the church, speaks of Christ driving the chariot across the sky as in the form of the sun, and also the fact that Christians would build their churches facing the direction of the sun and pray towards the sun, and these are the main elements which cause the confusion.